Hi, this is Jerry Conway, and you're listening to The Cave of Solitude.
Hi, my name's Ron Frenz, and you are listening to The Cave of Solitude podcast.
This is the legendary Tom DeFalco, and I hope you'll join me in The Cave of Solitude.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and once again, we are coming your way with some more footage from this year's Fan Expo Canada 2018, and this episode I deem very special, not that any of the other ones aren't, but this one is very special because we are taking a moment to remember the life and career of legendary comic book creator, none other than Steve Ditko. And for those of you who know, Steve Ditko is one of the most significant creators in all of comic book history, namely that he is the creator of characters such as Doctor Strange, Captain Atom, Mr. A. But if none of those characters ring a bell, perhaps you'll recognize names such as Aunt May, Uncle Ben, the Green Goblin, the Vulture, Dr. Octopus, Sandman, the Lizard. Oh, how about this character? The Amazing Spider-Man, the Spectacular Spider-Man, Peter Parker himself, one of the most recognizable characters in all of the world, not only North America or in comic book fandom. Globally, Spider-Man is a beloved character in many different various forms of media, and it can be said that Stan Lee is Spider-Man's daddy, and there's no doubt about that, but it can also be said that that Spider-Man is Steve Ditko's baby. Now, take it as you will, but without Steve Ditko's imagination, genius, and creativity, we would not have Spider-Man the way we have Spider-Man. It is his brainchild in more ways than we can imagine. And when you flip back through issues 1 through 38 of the Amazing Spider-Man comic book, not even to mention Amazing Fantasy 15, where it all started, all of the tracks, all of the groundwork, the entire mosaic that is the Amazing Spider-Man really starts off in everything that Steve Ditko did. So I got a chance to sit in on this memorial, if you will, remembering the life and career of Steve Ditko and understanding a lot of the things that he did in his work. It was hosted by Steve Ditko, historian and person who wrote biographies on Steve Ditko, Blake Bell, Amazing Spider-Man writer, current Amazing Spider-Man writer Nick Spencer, which was really cool to have him part of the panel. Mark Asquith, who is a television producer and also a comic historian, as well as local artist Steve Manale, who was a correspondent with Steve Ditko through the years, who actually got a chance to meet him. So this was a very well-rounded, diverse panel, all who had some sort of investment in the life and works of Steve Ditko, who were very well read and had an appreciation for his work throughout their years of being fans and creators themselves. So I love Spider-Man, as many people who listen to this show know. This was a hallmark year for the character, being that it was the 800th issue that was published of The Amazing Spider-Man. If you've listened to the show in the last couple of months, I had Kevin Boyd as well as Sam Noir on the show, where we did our favorite Spider-Man stories throughout the decades, which was a lot of fun to do. And if you listen to the bumpers that I put on here, it's an exhibit of riches, if you will, of the people who I've had really the privilege to talk to, people like Jerry Conway, Ron Frenz, Tom DeFalco, who have all added to the tapestry that is the Amazing Spider-Man mythos. But it wouldn't have started without the things that Steve Ditko did. And as Nick Spencer says at the beginning of the panel, he really owes much of his career, or everything that he's working on in his career currently, not his career in totality, but what he's doing with Spider-Man, he really, you know, has to tip his hat and bow his head to the works of Steve Ditko, who we sadly lost earlier this year, June 29th, 2018. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this panel. I'm going to try to put the volume up as high as you can to hear it. And it is important to note that there is going to be a lot of description of things that are visual. There's going to be some Steve Ditko art that was put up on a projector for the audience to look at and to kind of have the panel discuss. So if that kind of takes you out of it, I apologize. I'll try to put up some of those images if I can on the Cave of Solitude website so you can see what we're looking at. But regardless, I mean, it's wonderful to be able to hear people who understand, for me, understand the artwork and the art form better than I do, and kind of put things into perspective for me the next time I dig into my Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man omnibuses and look at the work of Steve Ditko. So without further ado, you've heard me enough. It's been 6 minutes. Fan Expo 2018, the Steve Ditko panel.
Thank you so much for being here in Toronto and Toronto Fan Expo Canada. We appreciate you all coming here today to remember a true comic book legend. I think you can throw that term around wildly, in some cases if you want, but I don't think there's too many creators throughout the history of the comic book medium who truly deserve that tag, which is a true comics legend. So we're all here today to remember and celebrate, really, and I focus on that really, celebrate the life of Steve Ditko, right? He had many years with us, 90 years with us, working literally until the end. I think he's the envy of a lot of comic book creators, working till the end of his life, literally producing new, exciting, interesting work right up until the end, doing it on his own terms, as we'll certainly talk about over the course of this 50-minute presentation. And really, he stands as a vanguard, not just for the superhero and the mainstream characters that he presented, but also, of course, for all the other independent work that he did and being a vanguard in that respect as well. So, to begin, I'll introduce myself, and then we'll let the panelists introduce themselves as well. So my name is Blake Bell. I've written a few books on Steve Ditko, not the least of which you're looking at on our made ad hoc presentation right there, using an old 19th century device. I don't know what that light thingy there that's projecting off of my touchpad there, so we ad hoc'd a little, improvised a little there. So 10 years ago, I wrote the Strange and Stranger of the World of Steve Ditko, and I've chronicled his pre-Marvel career through my Steve Ditko Archive series. If you're interested in any of those, there's some up at the front here later on for half price, if that so suits your fancy. I've also done some books on Bill Everett and Secret History of Marvel Comics and other books through the time. So again, I'm here moderating the panel, just again, out of an appreciation and a celebration for Ditko's life, and I'll turn it over to the gentleman on my right to introduce himself and go down the panel as well.
Hi, I'm Nick Spencer. I'm the current writer of The Amazing Spider-Man, which means I owe everything that I do right now to Steve Ditko. But also, not just in terms of the amazing work that he did there, but as a creative inspiration in general, as I just said, in terms of, doing things his own way and carving his own path, I think every creator can take some inspiration from that.
Hi, I'm Mark Asquith. I'm a television producer. I was involved in Comic Book Confidential and then a show called Prisoners of Gravity that I created, and then Space for the last 21 years. So my job has been to interview creators, and of course my white whale is Steve Ditko, who I never got to interview. And a startling admission, I would tell you, I started reading comics seriously in the mid-70s, and I did not like Steve Ditko's work.
On that note, okay.
My name's Steve Manelli. I draw kids' comics for Chickadee magazine. But I also hated Ditko's work when I was a kid. Obviously, that changed as I grew older. I think I was asked on this panel because I started a letter correspondence with Ditko around 2010, I think it was, 2009. And I had a chance to go down and meet him and talk to him, so I'll share some of that in a bit.
And you're Canadian as well, right?
I am a Canadian. I live in Toronto.
Excellent. Fantastic.
Wow.
I should have said I was Canadian. Did I not say I was Canadian? I apologize. So the first thing I wanted to start with, it was very interesting that you spoke to that, right? Your evolution in your admiration of Steve Ditko as purely as an artist and as a creator, right? The image that we're seeing here, this was going to be the original cover and title to my 2008 book. back in 2003, I think Fantagraphics agreed to produce the book. We called it Steve Ditko, The Mysterious Traveler. I thought it was a cool title, you know, because it riffed on the Tales of the Mysterious Traveler book. That's, you know, we've got a lot in those Steve Ditko archives. We printed it all. And I thought that was cool, and I thought this image, particularly the Who Am I image from those five-page stories he did pre-superhero Spider-Man and Doctor Strange, I thought that was really cool, and I thought, okay, career retrospective, like, how could this go wrong? How could Steve Ditko not, you know, at least be benign to this? And then, of course, he heard about this, and he saw it, and then he wrote in one of his essays in the comics that Gary Groth and I were, I can't even remember what it was, We were anti-Steve Ditko, and even worse is that he thought the book was going to be a poison sandwich. Now, there was a period of time between, you know, this and then what you saw before in terms of that. We really, it wasn't totally driven by his disdain for our efforts. But yeah, that image in particular, like, when I go back to being a youngster in the late 70s, picking up, obviously, I think most of us did, Spider-Man and Doctor Strange, I don't know if I was a loner, but I certainly had a foot in the loner camp. So I was certainly terribly intrigued by the radical difference between Ditko and Kirby in terms of what Jack Kirby seemed to have all these team books. Everyone who got powers seemed to have their life improved and better by it. But Steve Ditko always, for me, and what attracted me, was that he always drew these solitary characters who seemed to have the weight of the world on their shoulders, always shrugged shoulders, never chest puffed out, per se. And obviously the visual vernacular, like, when you knew it was Steve Ditko's world where you were inside. He wasn't an illustrator. He was truly an artist and a creator. So that cottoned on to me right from the start. So I was a fan of his work, and I certainly had to take the slings and arrows from the Byrne and the Miller acolytes in the 80s, who thought that was cool and Steve Ditko was too old-fashioned to exist. But as we go down the pipe, your first memories of Ditko, and were you like the rest, Nick, in terms of what were your first impressions of that, and did it stick or not?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that probably everybody of his first memory is maybe not loving it as much as they do now. I think that's, you know, because certainly for me, I don't think my first exposure, I think, you know, my first exposure to Spidey was probably Ross Andrews. So, you know, if your first exposures were things like Andrew or Romita, when you would go back and then see the Ditko stuff, you as a kid especially, I don't think you understood it. You know, it's hard to quantify the transformation that character undertook, you know, when the range shifted from Ditko to Romita. So, you know, I also think that so much of the kind of adult-oriented humor, the black humor, the dark humor, that I can see now in these early issues, I think. I always wonder, you know, how that stuff was received by the young readers of the time. Like, was it just flying over their heads, or were they getting into it? You know, it's a really interesting look at how an artist shapes your impression of a character. Because obviously, you know, Stan continued to write from for both, and so really seeing how so much of that with Steve is a fascinating thing, I think.
Mark?
I think that's a really interesting point. My Spider-Man was so far removed from the Romita and Ditko Spider-Man. To go back was interesting because Romita still seemed fresh. That, you know, it was still nostalgic for me, but the people that I liked were, you know, at the time, John Byrne, the guys who are currently doing the work. When my breakthrough at getting Ditko was the an issue of something called Mysterious Suspense featuring The Question. And the paper was terrible, it was badly printed, the color was off, but it was something about that story that was so focused and so intense that every time I reread that story, I said, wow, he's really telling a complicated story that really works. And then I went back and I started to look actually at the Monster comics, and really gaining affection for the Kirby and Ditko monsters, because there was something very pure and fresh about them. Yes, I still saw it through the lens of nostalgia, but after reading Mysterious Suspense, I thought, okay, no, this guy is different. He is different. There is something about his storytelling. There is something about his point of view. And there is something, frankly, at the time I didn't know what it was, but there's something different about this guy's politics.
You know, in the 80s, I think it was in the 80s, I was reading comic books as a kid, and I loved Spider-Man as a character. I liked the way he looked. I had a poster when I was a kid, a Romita poster. And I would go to the corner drugstore, which is the only place to buy comics when I was a kid. And I would get whatever had Spider-Man on it, whether it was Marvel Team-Up or Marvel Tales was one of them, which was a reprint book. But I didn't know that, so I would go to buy Amazing Spider-Man 1 month, and then I'd just go grab whatever had Spider-Man on it the next month, and the ugly artist, the ugly Spider-Man artist would be drawing that one, and it was Ditko. So it took me a long time to start recognizing artists. Because I was a little kid, I would just want to see the characters in action. I didn't even notice the art styles. But I noticed that I would start drawing from the books, and then I started copying the ugly artist the most, Ditko. And I think that's where my appreciation for his work grew. But I don't know. It's hard to say.
So Nick, when you talked about storytelling, a lot of people, Jim Starlin and other people, have talked about, because you don't see a lot of Ditko imitators as artists. Very challenging to imitate that style without coming, whereas there's a lot of people who descended from the Kirby school or other like that, but a lot of people also talked about the inspiration that he gave them from a storytelling perspective. You now writing the book after a pretty famous run by your predecessor, what have you taken from, or what and plan to take from a storytelling perspective that you think might have been inspired from Steve?
Well, I think that, you know, Steve had a grasp on the eccentricities of the world and the eccentricity of the character that sometimes, I think as time got on, those rougher edges were sort of, you could find themselves sanded down a little more. So I think you're always kind of trying to tap into that. I think that one thing that Ditko really brought to the book was a sense of the absurdity of the entire notion of the superhero, and certainly you know, those costume designs and the way that those fights are depicted, there's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek vibe to a lot of it that I try to tap back into as much as I can. Also, again, like I was saying before, letting the slightly pettier, slightly darker side of Pete sneak through every once in a while. That was something that was really intrinsic to the character during that run, that again, as he gets to college and girls start to pay attention to him and things like that tend to go away, which is a really logical character evolution, but sometimes it's good to be able to point back to that. So even on our first arc here, you know, the story is about having Peter Parker and Spider-Man split into two separate entities. And the Spider-Man side of that gets to lean on the Ditko interpretation a little more.
So Blake, you alluded to this earlier, but looking at Peter Parker, drawn by Ditko, he's carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's slumped over. There's something about the posture. There's something about that. And contrasting that with this amazingly designed costume, fighting these villains, just visually, you're like, well, this is what he likes. This is where he's having fun. And in a Ditko Spider-Man, I'm racking my brain to think, okay, when he drew Peter Parker, his feet were always on the ground. He was always slumped over. Did his Spider-Man ever have 2 feet on the ground? I don't think so. They were up against a wall. He was upside down. He was flying through the air.
It's like ballet, or like a circus carnival.
Absolutely. And so the contrast of those two things absolutely fascinated me when I went back, because I was like, and then you could tell, this is the person who's driving the storytelling of this comic. This is the driver in the driver's seat. Now, I grew up when I thought Stan Lee was God and that Stan Lee had plotted everything and written everything, because that's what the credits said. But after you started reading a lot of the Ditko and Kirby stories, you started going, actually, no. He was dialoguing it, which is different. But the story engine is Ditko. And that became completely obsessive to me, analyzing this guy's work and seeing how he's affected everybody in comics, essentially, from, you mentioned Jim Starlin, but you can see his influence in the work of on The Watchmen with Ditko, Dave Gibbons and Alan Moore.
Nine-panel grid, man. Nine-panel grid on every page. I mean, Ditko didn't always do that, but it seemed to be like a shorthand for a long time, maybe like once he was doing superhero books, really.
Yeah, I mean, we get the image that we have up here. So these are what you're going to see, again, poorly ad hoc here from a technology standpoint. These are top 10 Ditko images that I think represent his career as we go over the time, right?
The coolest drawing ever.
Yeah, he started in 1953. He started, a little later, and you got to remember that Ditko was starting in the 50s. He was one of the first, the first generation who actually had influences in comic books. Most people, like Will Eisner and all those who came before him, a lot of that generation really wanted to be like newspaper. They wanted a newspaper strip. They wanted to work in marketing because it was more glamorous and paid better. So comics was just grabbing the fad that they could at the time. So he was the first one that actually had influences. You could see a little Joe Kubrick, a little Mort Meskin in some of that work. But he started out in 1953, just coming from Jonestown, Pennsylvania, slogging to New York, working whatever he could, picking up little jobs here and there. He ran into Charlton Comics, which was like the Roger Corman production of the comic industry at the time, just churning out stuff, not really caring what was going in the books as long as it sold above a particular Mendoza line. And so he just ran right before the Comics Code Authority came into play and was doing a lot of, for about a year or so, that we capture in that Steve Ditko Archives Volume 1, doing a lot of really interesting pre-code horror work. So Steve, when you see images like this, what stylistically, what's striking you as an artist?
I think it was in that Jonathan Ross documentary, In Search of Ditko, with all the Alan Moore interviews and everything. I think someone, was it Moore who described his work as paranoid? Every drawing is paranoid? It's the perfect word to describe it, even his superhero stuff, but this is one paranoid-looking drawing to me.
But for me, it's the acting. I mean, he really understood that what would connect you to the story were the characters and the emotions. And, I mean, this is slightly melodramatic, but what the heck.
Yeah, I just love the intensity of it. It really hits you. I mean, imagine seeing that on a stand. You know, you would grab it. Look at his chest. It's so gross.
Well, we think of, the Comics Code Authority, we think sort of the state or, the comics of that time for kids, but, there's comic books from 1954 of Ditko with arms lopped off, people dropped into vats of acid, so he was certainly not above getting into that sort of EC Comics horror-inspired work at the time. You guys mentioned some of that dichotomy in Ditko's work. I certainly remember the notion of, to me, the greatest split, like maybe we can talk about this from a storytelling perspective. The dichotomy for me was the fact that, I think I mentioned this slightly, that when everyone else got their superpowers, Captain America went from a little, a little tiny wimp to now I'm an icon, I'm representative. And to me, the schism in comic book history that sort of changed it was that when Peter Parker got his superheroes, he thought he was king of the world, right? That for he's going to go home, he's great, the day he saved the spaceship, the guy, Jameson's son in the spaceship, he thinks he's going to go home, he's going to find great newspaper headlines, all of a sudden, boom, it's Fox News has vilified him as, a menace to society, fake news, in its beginnings. And off he goes, all of a sudden his life is completely worse, and he's living in that shadow from a personal standpoint the whole time. To me, that revolutionized what comics were all about and allowed you to tell, as you were saying, that allowed you to tell two stories at the same time.
That comic was the first comic I ever read to my little brother when he was 5 years old. He'd never read a comic. Is that Amazing Fantasy or is that Spider-Man number one?
That's Spidey-1.
Spidey-1. That story with the Jameson capsule rescue. And at the end, when Jameson still declared Peter Parker, or Spider-Man, a menace, even though he'd saved his son, my little brother burst into tears.
I have to correct you. It's threat or menace, Steve.
Right, threat or menace. Yeah, greatest threat or menace.
So as we move along here in our top 10, Steve eventually had to leave New York in late 1954 because he had reoccurring bouts with tuberculosis. So he went home to Johnstown, Pennsylvania to recoup, but then came back in late 1955 with the Derby, Connecticut plant that housed Charlton Comics, all its printed presses, and all of really the artists that would set up shop there. It went under. They had a massive flood. It went completely under. So they shut down for, I can't remember, it was up to about 6 months or so. So Ditko went looking for other work, and he ended up landing, as a lot of people don't really know, he ended up landing at Marvel Comics in late 55, early 56, doing these little four-page vignettes for Marvel Comics. He only did about, I think, about 19 of them before Marvel Comics famously imploded because their owner switched from his own distribution to American News Company, who then went under and forced Marvel to really constrict their line. But again, this image is one of my favorites because, again, his use of negative imagery and using those blacks to really pop. To me, he was the first artist. I mean, you had people like Eisner, but in the 50s, when people were really drained out of the industry, to have him still working on this. What do you guys see when you see this image? What leaps out at you guys?
It's like the poor man's Michael Cho. Shout out to Michael Cho. He's not here anymore.
Well, to me, I love the first panel, but to me, it's the second panel that's very interesting, which reminds me a lot of Wally Wood, and it's a lot of classic kind of... I love circles in comics, and that's one of those classic Flash Gordon, Frank Frazetta, Al Williamson-y kind of panels. But to me, the page doesn't work, because it almost seems like, well, wait a minute, those three panels don't feel like they're connecting. So what's going on? Which is not necessarily a bad thing in terms of storytelling, because it actually gets you to turn the page.
This is the anti-Steve Ditko panel, right?
No, I love the despondence of the first panel. That's a nice, sad acting expression, man. That's great.
He used this motif a lot, where he would have that the first panel in this particular period of time, where he'd have the first panel really close up, really trying to send a key message for what the mood or tone of the story was going to be, and then the second panel he'd pull back, so you got some perspective on different characters and a little bit of the setting, and then boom, he'd go right in the third panel, right to those faces to say, okay, we're going to zone in on these characters are going to drive the story. And to me, as you guys are saying, that's what would make me want to turn that page, to be able to see, okay, what is next with this, with these things that we've seen? Not necessarily, as you were saying, Mark, the sequential storytelling 101, but I thought it was a very interesting push and pull dynamic. So Nick, as you go forward, you talked about the notion of splitting those two personalities, the two segments into one. To me, that was also, between the split face Spider-Man mask, and where did that concept come up that you were going to pull those two apart and explore that?
Well, it just seemed like a great first art character examination idea that, because so much of his life is the push and pull between his identity as Spider-Man and his life as Peter, and how the two are constantly bumping into each other and constantly costing each other something. It seemed like isolating them and having them be able to look at each other and interact with each other and learn from each other and things like that would give us a nice entry level story, a nice way to kind of re-examine what this character means, what the ethos behind the character is, and we took the with great power must also come great responsibility, and just split it, where one side of the character has all the power and the other side has all the sense of responsibility, and it's a simple trick, but as a way in the door, as a way of kind of laying down the foundation, I think it's fun.
Did you go into this run having, because over now 50 some odd years, multiple iterations of the book, did you go in having that idea, or was that something, okay, I've got the book and now I'm thinking I have different ideas to come up with?
No, in fact, what was fun about that is there's a thank you in the first issue. It was in researching and for another story idea, I had seen somebody throw out the idea out there on the internet, and I immediately reached out to first talked to Marvel, and then we reached out to the person in question and said, hey, we love this idea, we want to use it. So yeah, his name is Anthony Reeves, and He's got a nice little thank you in the first issue and stuff. He was very excited, so that was fun. And, the book actually has a long history of that kind of thing. That's actually where the black suit Spider-Man comes from. So, but when I saw it, the idea was something along the lines of Spider-Man and Peter Parker get split into two separate personas, hilarity ensues. And I was like, yeah, that'll work. That'll work. Sometimes it's that easy. I was looking for, as we're building our sort of long-term story and big plot line, I was just looking for something to kind of drill down in. Thankfully it happened along my way.
Mark, you talked about your interest in the intensity of Ditko's non-Spider-Man work. That's intense philosophical stuff. Many people may know in the audience that after Ditko left Spider-Man and Doctor Strange abruptly in late 65, 1966, after only like 3+ years on sort of the Spider-Man, he went off to do some intensely philosophical work based on the objectivist Ayn Rand, who wrote The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. So again, we talk about dichotomy and split personalities, really, as an artist. You know, he was building some of those ideas into the Spider-Man work. You can certainly see, for those who don't know, Ayn Rand had this notion of a romantic hero and an objectivist. She was an objectivist philosopher. Everything was rational, and heroes were supposed to be heroes, and villains were supposed to be villains. And you know, Ditko, that was a key trait going forward. So he had the same split in his work, right, where he would do mainstream superhero work, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, but then he would do his intense political work. You talked about the intensity of that story. What else, as you went down the path of getting to know Ditko greater as a storyteller and his work, what else partnered you out of that, or impressed you, or didn't impress you at certain times about that?
First of all, you just triggered something when you talked about the fact that heroes had to be heroes. This week we lost the great Marie Severin, a fantastic artist and colorist that worked for EC Comics and Marvel. She famously drew an issue where the hero was going to be drunk, and he would not draw a hero drunk. He said, "Nope, that will not happen." So she came in and drew it, and that kind of purity of vision, that kind of like this is what a hero is. You can go back and see that work in the 50s. It's a really hard thing to talk about because, you know that famous visual illusion where is it two faces or is it a vase? And once you see them, then you can never unsee them. Once you learn that a lot of Ditko is about Ayn Rand and about polarity and the black and the white, and reading Mr. A, which I'm so glad Steve brought it, I was going to bring my copy. I was obsessed by these comics, but it's so clear. Then when you go back and look at Spider-Man, it completely, I don't know, it's like a decoder ring. You know, you put the decoder ring and all of a sudden you see all the stuff for the first time. You see the faces and the vase, and you're like, oh my God, he was doing this all along. But it took me a while to get there. I'm not particularly bright. I think that's what that was about. But what about you, Steve?
Well, Mark, were you and I talking about, when we were out a couple weeks ago, I think, was it you and I talking about, maybe it was with J-Bone before you got there, but we were talking about how Ditko, when he went back to Marvel, what year did he go back to Marvel after Spider-Man? Like,
late 70s,
he went on to Machine Man because he said he wouldn't work on a flawed hero, a hero who had, Peter Parker was okay back in the day because he was a kid and he was still learning what it is to be good and what it is to be moral, so he could make bad decisions or weak decisions, but if he's working on a superhero book that isn't a kid, the hero had to be infallible and always do the right thing and always be pure. And they said, I guess we'll give him Machine Man because he's a robot. He can't really.
And he later did ROM, right?
And then after Machine Man ended, he was like, well, I'll work for you guys. I'm free to do work. And they went, I guess ROM? He's kind of a robot?
Micronauts?
Micronauts? They're kind of robots? They can't really do anything wrong because they're programmed not to. So I thought that was fascinating, man. For an artist to be that committed to his vision of what a hero is, that he basically was stuck to doing robots at the end. Kind of amazing.
He did the Transformers coloring book. Like, Marvel had a book division as well. So
I got that.
you know, Transport, he did GoBots, he did, I think some of that was also, I mean, remember, this was the company that Kirby came back to and drew Captain America, and there was alleged infighting as whether he was too old school at the time. So I think some of that's giving Ditko those types of characters where, well, if we don't have to draw those humans with the big cheekbones that look like they're from, you know, in the fedoras from the 1950s or 60s, well, we'll give them robots and all that stuff because it won't, his quote-unquote old style won't reveal itself in those types of books as well, which is, you know, interesting. But it's right, the John Galt character right out of Atlas Shrugged, right? That was his deal, right? I will work at the lowest rung possible in the world just to be able to sustain myself so that I can go away and go into the mountains and do my awesome, super independent mind ideas, and just go follow that template, you know, all the way to the end.
Just a slight aside about Rom that I always thought was really cool was that at this point, Ditko, by the company, I think, was they didn't really get it and they didn't really understand his legacy. But the inkers on Rom, the people who inked him, were John Byrne and P. Craig Russell, and all these guys were jumping at a chance to ink Ditko. And I really thought that was cool. I loved those issues because it was like you could see, oh, so this is how we influence these people.
Those P. Craig Russell ones are actually pretty cool looking.
They're beautiful. The Byrne ones are good, too. They're really good. Yeah.
So, Nick, as you were growing up and your evolution, what was the entry point with Ditko and then subsequent work that you admired afterwards, if the entry point was, like, the usual suspects?
Yeah, I mean, my first exposure was definitely Spider-Man, but then I was a big Doctor Strange fan as a kid, too, so... that stuff. I think the Doctor Strange stuff is really where I learned to love the work because again, like we just saw on this page here, the sort of you know, intense attention to the detail and the psychedelic images and things like that that only he could do. You know, that stuff. Left out to me on visual media. So I think that was my first, like, real positive impression.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I think that Doctor Strange stuff was just amazing and mind-blowing. And again, I mentioned almost as an aside, you know, I'm kind of obsessed by circles in comics, and the Doctor Strange's Sanctum Sanctorum had the most beautiful window. And what was so nice is that when Ditko drew the room again, it would have that window. And in comics, particularly with, you know, I love Jack Kirby, but his machinery would mutate throughout something. But Ditko was trying to ground things in a much more tangible way, and you began to feel the reality of what he was creating. And then, of course, that worked really well, because then you put it up against Nightmare, you put it up against these surreal landscapes, and it works. It completely works.
I remember I had a comic book when I was a kid. It was Man-Bat number one. I think it was number one. Did he draw that one, Blake? And it's Ditko drawing Batman, which I don't even know how many times he did that in his career, but it is so weird looking. He draws him skinny and rangy and creepy, and it looks amazing. I love the way it looked. It was just so unlike any other version of Batman that it kind of haunted me as a kid. It just didn't even look like Batman to me, but it was burned into my brain to the point where I found my childhood copy of it just recently, and I blew that panel up big and made it into a poster. It's pretty cool. You should check it out.
So I've jumped ahead in our presentation here just to this, because we were talking about Doctor Strange, to this famous page, right? And that famous panel, I think that panel probably got reposted more times when Steve passed away last month. I think it was, I don't know if I can remember, it was Jim Starlin or if it was P. Craig Russell when I was talking to them for the book, said he was almost cubist in the sense that if you really look at this, it's really just sort of circles and all these, just these regular shapes all sort of put together in an interesting dynamic that we'd never seen before, right? You know, magic and all that stuff back in the day, they were all just wisps, you know, wind and all this stuff, but Ditko was the first one to really go 3D, and just, but again, just all these just different shapes that were normal, just rearranged in a way we hadn't seen before.
So, it's so beautiful.
And again, Doctor Strange was, again, a sort of a mirror of Peter Parker from the perspective of you had an outsider sort of trapped, and again, this sort of talks to what you were talking about, Nick, around that dichotomy. He was almost trapped between two worlds. He had one foot in each world, right? Doctor Strange had a foot in the human world, but wasn't really appreciated or rejected because he had to hide out in his sanctum. But he also had a foot in the other world where he was trying to defend Earth, but nobody knew it. So again, completely unappreciated, completely unknown, and that stark solo character. That as you go through your run, Nick, and you're thinking about that darker side, so how does that balance off with the humor aspect?
Well, I mean, they go hand in hand, really. And I think that, you know, going back to those original Spidey issues and a lot to Doctor Strange, you know, Ditko Ditko characters are maybe a little crankier, leaning into that certainly in terms of Stephen Strange, I think that's a thing that continued with the character, that he remains kind of the standoffish Marvel character. A lot of times, I think you know, the best interpretation of Strange is always the one where he's a little bit aside from the other heroes, maybe looking down the nose a little bit at them, maybe not always intentionally. With Peter, there's a lot that still carries over, even if you know, kind of the individualist stuff, doesn't always stick. I think that Spider-Man really thrives when he's an outsider, and he's not really a joiner. I still struggle as much as I loved, the things like New Avengers and stuff like that. I still struggle with the idea of Spider-Man on a team. And I think a lot of that is Ditko. I think that he did such a good job of kind of isolating the character and making the character feel removed from all this other stuff, this circus around him. I think that that's still a part of the character's DNA.
It's so interesting you talk about that, because as I developed in some of my philosophical views, I looked at Ayn Rand's objectivism as sort of the Bible with Jesus taken out of it, which is the power source, which is probably explains why objectivism never got off the ground. But there's an interesting expression in the Bible. It's a Greek word called hupomene, and it's the translation is bearing up under the weight of it, right? So when I think of the Romita books, and God love John, we've had this conversation, right? He was all of a sudden now a joiner. It was almost as Stanley took over because Ditko and Stan hadn't talked for that last year. They just, Ditko handed him the pages, and they were dialogue, and that was it. So Ditko was driving that narrative towards the end of that journey of him becoming a true, romantic hero in Ayn Rand's vision. But as soon as Ditko left the book, boom, in goes Lee. They impose the college lifestyle, the joiner lifestyle. He's now handsome. He's got shiny teeth. You know, I can see Ditko characters with, like, just rotted teeth, that Doctor Strange, the little cigarette, the little marijuana-looking cigarette hanging out his mouth and the crappy hair. So it completely co-opted and just went completely mainstream. It was still a lovely book to look at, because Romita was a great illustrator, and it was still a fun book, and they did a lot of interesting stuff. But yeah, it just lost that segregationist, that loner aspect that we came to love.
Yeah, it does. To me, it really works as a story, because I think that for lots of people, your high school experience is a very different one from your college experience. That that the college years are a lot of times when people do kind of blossom. But I think survives, interestingly enough, is while in his college life and in Peter's life, suddenly he's got a beautiful girlfriend, and he's got these friends, and even his old bullies and foils become kind of friends, and Flash becomes somebody that he's actually very close to. While those relationships transform, some of that outsider stuff still really sticks to the Spider-Man identity.
Through the identity concerns of Aunt May and things like that, right?
He's still kind of very much his own man, and very much the individualist on that side of things.
Did you guys have a problem with the new Spider-Man movie where he's got kind of a giant team? He's got Iron Man helping him, then Iron Man's assistant helping him, then he's got his aunt's helping him, then he's got a best friend who knows, but he's also got a suit that has AI that talks to him, and so he's got kind of a giant team helping him out here for like a loner character. I like the movie, but it's pretty un-Spider-Man.
So as we go forward here, we when Ditko left Marvel, he still did some of his best work. And this is a representation of that. He worked for Warren Comics, Archie Goodwin, and of course famous for many things as an editor and a writer, but he tried to recreate the EC Comics world in the mid-60s and drew in all these fantastic artists of the day, Wally Woods, Gene Colan, and Steve Ditko. Steve Ditko did a number of ink wash stories, but also this really intricate, almost like, you know, wood engraving type work. Mark, do you remember the Warren work and your impression?
Yeah, I do. And I, again, it was, I also have an obsession with black and white comics, and to be able to see Gene Colan work with Wash and Neil Adams and all the great artists like obviously Alex Toth, there's something about that. You can actually see the detail that in comics in the 60s, a lot of this stuff gets covered up by bad coloring and bad printing. These were well printed. They were handsome books, and so yeah, I sought them out. But for the first time, you could really see the detail that Ditko was putting into the material.
I agree.
Excellent. So then
there we go. There's the famous
nine-panel grid that I love.
So then as we really, I think 1967 really marked an important point in Ditko's career. The book that his friend was doing, I don't want to call it prozine, or just we'll call it a straight magazine, Wits End, by his friend and compatriot Wally Wood, began publishing. And Wits End 3 had this first story, Mr. A. So Mr. A was based, again, on a chapter out of an Ayn Rand book, you know, A is A. Very much the hero was a hero. They were black and white. There was no gray. And this particular page, to me, is another one of those pages that turned comics on its ear, perhaps not so much at the time as later, because this is the story of Mr. A, where this person, this character, Angel, this bad teenager, Angel, here in that second panel, he's hanging off a flagpole, which is almost a middle finger to Spider-Man and that whole perspective, right? Because Spider-Man was always saved by the flagpole. And he's dangling. After he's tried to kill this woman, he's dangling off this flagpole, and Mr. A is saying, do you want me to save this bad guy? And she's a bleeding heart liberal, as portrayed by Ditko, and say, oh, it's not his fault. He's just a product of his environment. You know, please save him. And as you see in the bottom tier of panels, the character Angel drops to his death, and Mr. A gives that famous last panel where he says, you know, even if I could have saved him, I wouldn't. I would have just let him die anyway, because he's not worthy of it. And it's an insult to victims that we actually try to reform these career criminals. And to have a character, for a superhero, quote unquote superhero, to let someone drop to their death versus, you know, what we always have to see. And there was a story in The Question, again, more mainstream at the time, where the superhero let someone, The Question let a guy, a villain, fall down a sewer, like a rushing water sewer, and they had to put in there after the fact, I better call the police to have this guy pick him up, because he couldn't get away with this stuff in his mainstream stuff. So you really start to see that the Hawk and the Dove had some political battles. Obviously, the Hawk and the Dove had those battles. And after that, Ditko really gave up trying to put stuff into that type of philosophy into the books. But he really was the first one to do that. He was the first one to introduce philosophical and intellectual arguments into comic books. So, Steve, you've got a few items there for when he went completely doing his own independent
work.
Oh,
yeah.
What attracted you to this type of work?
Well, I think that first of all, I don't agree with a lot of his philosophies. I think that I'm a pretty gray area guy. I'm a liberal. but I loved that he was so passionate about it that he would put up these giant, thick volumes, and there would be essays and kind of pseudo comics with, you know, talking heads just spouting philosophies that he believed in, and then there would be massive essays in the middle of the comics, and then it would go back to just a straightforward adventure story. But they got weird and more intense and more personal, and I always wanted to know what the guy was like. Is he this obsessive, you know, I was wondering if he was like a Jack Chick guy putting out those religious track comics where he just needed to distance himself from his superhero work in order to put out these.
Well, in your correspondence, did you ask him that?
We did talk, and you know, it's funny. I met Ditko, I went to go meet him. We started exchanging letters, which Darwin told me would never happen.
friend of mine told me that he would never respond because he's anti-fandom, which isn't the case at all. If you look online, he actually responded to almost every fan letter, right?
Like, yeah, I've got the same thing. I got a bunch, and even when he didn't like me, he was still go back and forth.
But it's funny. His initial letters were, if you look them up online, if you look up Ditko letters, I think there's a Facebook.
Put them under there.
There's a Facebook group now. I'll put one under here, but it's kind of, I got to zoom out. I'll zoom wider. And it looks horrible. Hang on a second. I don't know how to make this read.
Steve just bought a blank piece of paper in here, and he's pretending that it's a Steve Ditko letter.
That's right. I'll read this one to you. This is a really short one. This is typical of like most of the letters.
It's all written in pencil, right? Said,
handwritten by pencil.
It's also Steve. We're down to 3 minutes as well, so
I know. We're good. Okay, don't worry. I picked a short
first
one.
Paragraph.
Dear Steve, everyone has to or should. I wrote him about my cartooning work. And here, everyone has to or should work under whatever the conditions for the way he believes he will get the best results. The method, style, etc. should fit the type of end needed or desired. It's better not being concerned about comparative standards or measuring one's efforts in effect with others' results. Every individual mind and hand has its own unique creative power. Regards, Steve Ditko. Which is basically him saying, I don't really like your stuff. but at the time when I got the letter, I thought it was pretty, I'm like, oh yeah, right, why am I comparing my work to anyone else's work? He's right, my own personal measure of success and greatness is all that matters. And then as time went on, our correspondences got more personal and more chatty and friendly, and about how we both love McDonald's foods guiltily. But we talked about Mr. A, and that's when I met him, and I went down to meet him in New York, and I asked him about Mr. A, and he laughed. He laughed out loud. He went, Mr. A, man, no one's ever read an issue of Mr. A to the end. And I said, what, are you serious? And he said, no one can read that stuff. It's just for me. Wow. I was stunned that he was so self-effacing and self-aware about this weird, turgid, intense comics that I find mesmerizing and impenetrable at the same time. And he was totally aware of it, and he laughed, and we talked a little bit about, you know, after Spider-Man, the characters he created, Creeper, we talked about Shade the Changing Man, and who else? Someone else. And he said, oh, no one likes any of those characters. People hate those characters. They're never going to be popular. They're too weird. And I was surprised at how aware he was that, you know, his weirdness had taken over.
You know, guys, I just for time, I apologize that we could go on for another hour here, but I'll just close and leave you guys with one thing. First of all, I want to thank all the panels here. If we can get a big round of applause. We're remembering Steve Ditko. I think we can remember, yes, he created signature characters in Spider-Man and Doctor Strange that will live well beyond all of us, probably, in our interpretations or interest in them. But if I was going to leave you with one thing, it's, you know, it wasn't that he didn't like people, it wasn't that he didn't like life, it wasn't that, you know, but he didn't do a ton of interviews because, and I talked to him about this, because he didn't have any interest in fame, right? He did the work for the work. He wanted to communicate the work. Just because he didn't court celebrity, just because he didn't, you know, riff off a whole bunch of recreations of things that could have made him, you know, millions of dollars, he, by the blessing of his own talents, was able to live his life to the fullest to say, no, I'm going to do my own work, and there are people up on the stage who've done their own work as well as, you know, company-owned work as well. I'm going to do it my way, and that's the way I'm going to do it, and you can like it or lump it, but at the end of the day, it's the work that speaks for me, and that will be my lasting forever. Someone who did it their way and did it their entire lives and enjoyed it.
I'd like to say one last thing, that he is a very widely assumed to be kind of a humorless guy because of the intensity of his work and his personal work and even his mainstream work, but I found him to be quite funny, and I thought he was a funny guy, and I wasn't expecting that, and I think that was proved by a letter that I saw printed, a handwritten letter just like this that someone posted recently I saw online, and it was in response to a request that the person had made and said, Dear Steve, I'm a huge fan. Can I please get an autograph? And in handwritten in pencil, it said, I'm sorry, I do not provide autographs. Sincerely, Steve Ditko.
Guys,
I'll close
on that. If you have any of my books that you've seen earlier, they're right here to my left. And again, thank you all for coming as well. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
So there you have it, folks. I hope you enjoyed listening to this panel that was hosted at Fan Expo Canada 2018. And it's just a small snippet of the type of panels that you get from being at a show like that. I was really glad to be in attendance. I learned a lot listening about it. I'm definitely going to read some of my old Spider-Man comics differently. I hope it piques your interest in looking, taking a deep dive into some of the history of the Amazing Spider-Man books and some of the other things Steve Ditko worked on that I wasn't even fully aware of. So stay tuned. I'm going to have some more footage, just a little bit more coming from this year's show. And then after that, it's going to be our regularly scheduled program with different interviews, guests, and also topics that we're going to talk about. So if you want to email us, reach out to caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. Just look for Cave of Solitude. I've been your host, Eric Anthony. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back soon.